This is 40A&M N5, a weekly download of 40A&M LLC. For more information and for our terms of use, visit 40A-M.com. Europe is getting a new data protection supervisor. What may be hot on his agenda? Sony comes out with a, wait for it, paper watch. And you thought your time was thin. And what are kids doing on the internet these days? And will they be all right? All this and more. This is 40A&M in 5, the weekly download of 40A&M LLC. It's Monday, December 8th, and I'm Chris Bohm. First up, two new sets of data on global internet usage have made a splash within the past 2 weeks. The first is the Measuring the Information Society project of the United Nations International Telecommunications Union. It predicts that by the close of 2014, the internet will be used by 3 billion people around the world, an increase of roughly 300 million people since last year. That's like adding a population of new users equivalent to the United States in just last year alone. But as Washington Post's Nancy Scola noted in her column on November 26th, even that burgeoning online population tends to look a lot like that of the U.S. Relatively well-off, pretty educated, and on the young side. Another new set of data comes from the OECD, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, based in Paris. Now, I've become pretty familiar with the OECD's biannual broadband data set, and there aren't great surprises in this latest edition. More growth, certainly, but no huge surprises. Less than 60% of adults in Mexico, Turkey, Italy, and Greece are online. But when you look at the Nordics in particular, Denmark, Finland, Norway, Sweden, and toss in Iceland, about 90% of the adult populations are online. A little more to do in these markets on cold winter nights, perhaps. But among all OECD countries, some 95% of 16 to 24-year-olds go online. In the Netherlands and Estonia, for instance, 80% of students go online before they turn 10. Ah, the youth factor. What are some of them doing online, you may ask? Or you may not want to ask. This week, we want to spotlight a bit of the positive, or at least thought-provoking, and pieces by both Manvi Singh and Laura Silverman, both of National Public Radio, help us to do that. Let's start with Manvi Singh's segment on November 26th, which focuses on research out of the University of Queensland, Australia, and the question, yes, the kids are online, but are they all right? The answer seems to be yes, according to the NPR piece. The Monitoring the Future project, which is the data that the University of Queensland analyzed, surveys about 50,000 U.S. high school students annually. The conclusion that the researchers reached was that loneliness among teens has been generally declining, slowly and very slightly, over the past 30 years, but the data also suggests that teens today may have fewer close friends and also feel less of a need to make more friends. According to Manvi Singh's segment, David Clark, a PhD candidate who led the study, believes that this could mean that young people today are more individualistic than they used to be. And they may not need as much social interaction to feel satisfied. Perhaps. But his colleague also adds that there's a lot of that researchers still don't understand about the impact of social media, for instance on mental health. And it's clear that some behaviors and use of social media are healthier than others. A bit like offline life, maybe. But the next day, November 27th, NPR's Lauren Silverman takes us in a slightly different direction into healthcare. What are young doctors doing with the internet technology, and how has it changed both their education and perhaps the way they will practice? She notes that many millennial doctors have never worked with paper charts or dusty medical journals. They look at them online. As a result, it's a safe bet that when they meet patients, they'll be behind a laptop or at least glancing at their smartphones. Some doctors are reluctant to embrace all of this as a good trend, noting, as one did in the Silverman piece, that as physicians we value our dogfighting skills, talking to a patient, interacting with a patient. But the same docs also note that, whereas residents in the 1980s often carried the inhuman hours of their work and broken marriages as a badge of honor, first-year residents today aren't allowed to work more than 16-hour shifts, unlike the old 30 hours. Few of these new doctors, NPR notes, want to be the iconic Marcus Welby, working alone and making house calls. Many millennial physicians are choosing hospital teams and group practices. But regardless of how you might feel about how the shift to group practice and impacts to continuity of care may play out, It's clear that, as Lawrence Silverman reports, there's one thing that holds true for every generation. The goal is to take care of patients. At the very least, if your critical care doctor is better rested and happy, that does sound like a good thing. For those of you out there with school-aged young children, ponder this. If Flat Stanley could have a watch, what would it look like? Well, Sony may have answered that question this past week. Sony has developed a watch made from, you guessed it, e-paper. The Wall Street Journal reported that Sony has deliberately kept the development of the watch very low-key, even opting to use a spin-off division called Fashion Entertainments to work on the e-paper watch. The journal noted that Fashion Entertainments had actually banked on a crowdfunding campaign to gauge public interest, raising roughly $30,000. Although the watch does not have all the functionality of a smartwatch, the battery of the e-paper watch will last far longer without a recharge, roughly 60 days of use. The technology at use here is reportedly similar to what's used in an e-book reader, such as Amazon's Kindle. The watch face and straps have an e-paper display. Gadget expert Stuart Miles commented to the BBC's Dave Lee that he found the e-paper watch retro and cool. But please, no more jokes about time wearing thin. One of the most bizarre and vexing developments over the past week has both cybersecurity and the entertainment industry in the crosshairs. The Guardian's Ben Child reported on December 1st that Sony Studios is investigating the possibility that its servers were hacked by North Korea, in apparent retaliation for Sony's new comedy film, The Interview, due to be released on Christmas Day here in the U.S., which, as its premise, has two light entertainment talk show hosts inveigled by authorities to attempt to assassinate the North Korean leader. North Korean Ambassador Yasung Nam had written a letter to the United Nations Secretary General, Ban Ki-moon, in July, decrying the yet-to-be-released film as an act of war. Not the typical response you hear regarding Christmas-release buddy comedies. When asked about cyber attack by the BBC News and whether North Korea was involved, a spokesman for the North Korean mission said, "I kindly advise you just to wait and see." According to Reuters, the U.S. Federal Bureau of Investigation issued a 5-page confidential warning to U.S. businesses on Monday of this week, warning that cyber hackers have used malicious software to launch destructive attacks in the U.S. And the warning follows a confirmation from the FBI that they are investigating the Sony hack. For Sony, the hack is and could prove to be a serious business development, with the studio's revival of the musical Annie being one of the pictures leaked to pirate websites weeks before it is released for the holiday season. The losses, according to The Guardian's Ben Lee, could register into the hundreds of millions of dollars. Other films believed to have been leaked include the Mike Leigh biopic, Mr. Turner, and the Julianne Moore film, Still Alice, both of which are rumored to be Oscar-caliber performances. If you monitor the privacy legal landscape in Europe to any degree, you know that the selection of the next European Data Protection Supervisor, or EDPS, has been a hot topic for months now, with Giovanni Buttarelli, the deputy EDPS to Peter Hustings, rumored to be the frontrunner for at least the past month. On December 2nd, the National Law Review confirmed that Mr. Buttarelli will in fact be the next EDPS, and he has declared his intention to continue increasing the activity and visibility of the supervisor's role, continuing its long rise in prominence under the helm of Peter Hustings. Now that the official appointment has occurred, the Parliament and the Council must sign off on the nomination decision, but Mr. Buttarelli's qualifications and experience likely make this a formality, unlike the short list of candidates rejected since the European Commission embarked on a process to find a new EDPS back in July 2013. As discussed by attorney Chris Kuhner in his op-ed for the Privacy Advisor this past week, a new call for candidates came this past May, and both Mr. Hustings and Mr. Buttarelli had agreed to remain in their original posts until successors could finally be chosen. It's no doubt that the role of the EDPS will become even more critical once the proposed European Data Protection Regulation is adopted. The European Data Protection Board, which is to be the successor to the Article 29 Working Party, is likely, according to Mr. Kuhner, to have the EDPS as its secretariat, which would have significant influence on how the regulation is interpreted and implemented. Attorney Eduardo Usteron, who had written an article for Hogan Lovell's Chronicle of Data Protection in early November, had spotlighted that the need for greater harmonization has always been a primary motivation that convinced the European Commission to reform the existing EU data protection legal framework. It was also a primary reason why the Commission had suggested a regulation, rather than a new directive, so that the rules would automatically flow into national law. The fact that the regulation is likely to be the outcome would certainly be a victory for the Commission. The privacy advisors, Angelique Carson, wrote on November 20th, after interviewing Luca De Matteis, Justice Counselor and Permanent Representative of Italy to the EU, that the Council draft of the regulation expected to be presented this month will likely be far less prescriptive, emphasizing that privacy is a fundamental right, but also by bolstering European protections with a more flexible risk-based approach to data regulation. Ms. Carson added that Mr. De Matteis also anticipates preservation of the critical one-stop-shop concept, a mechanism that would streamline address of data protection issues with one DPA overseeing companies based in a local jurisdiction. But added Mr. De Matteis, we want to do this correctly and in a way that's workable, ensuring there is not only consistency in applying the law among DPAs, but also a lack of hardship under such a process for data subjects seeking a remedy across borders. Black Friday, Cyber Monday, Giving Tuesday. Of the three, the first two are domains purely of the U.S. no longer. Since 2001 in the U.S., the Friday after Thanksgiving holiday, Black Friday as it's called, has been the biggest shopping day of the year. Over the past several years, retailers in the United Kingdom have been engaging in Black Friday-type promotions, and consumers in the U.K. seem to have taken to the tradition. According to the BBC, the number of visits to brick-and-mortar U.K. shops on Black Friday picked up last year, rising 5.6%. But this year has proved to be record-breaking, with Amazon UK reporting that Black Friday this year was its busiest ever, with sales that surpassed all expectations. According to the BBC, Amazon UK recorded orders for more than 5.5 million goods, with about 64 items sold per second. For its part, Amazon had begun recognizing Black Friday in the UK in 2010. With sales improving marginally year by year until this year's seeming explosion. As the BBC reported this past Sunday, the online trade of this Black Friday had retailers such as John Lewis, Tesco Direct, and Argos struggling to handle the increased traffic. In the US, a somewhat different dynamic has emerged, as many retailers this year began the traditional Black Friday sales with discounts starting on Thursday, Thanksgiving Day. Walmart reported that Thursday was in fact its second highest online sales day ever, and retailer Best Buy's website even went offline for a time after what the company termed was a concentrated spike in mobile traffic last Thursday. According to ShopperTrack, which tracks data on retailers globally, Black Friday has been the top sales day of the year since 2005. And that will be all for us again this week. You have been listening to 40 AM in 5. For more information and for our terms of use, visit 40a-m.com. All stories for this week's download were reported by at least two online or print news sources or taken directly from relevant releases, with the exception of specific reporting highlighted from the UN's ITU, the OECD, the Washington Post, National Public Radio, the National Law Journal, the Privacy Advisor, Reuters, The Guardian, and the Wall Street Journal. Thank you for listening. 40 AM and 5 will be back with you again on Monday, December 15th. Until then, of course, make this week and every week one to remember. And bye for now.